Become a Webmaster Radio VIP member for only 99 cents a day and enjoy access to all the newest and coolest features on the WebmasterRadio.fm website. With our VIP membership, you'll have exclusive access to over 1,000 episodes of Webmaster Radio programming. So what are you waiting for? Sign up and become a VIP member today. It's fast, it's easy, and it's convenient. WebmasterRadio.fm. We're everywhere.
Hey, what are you reading?
Revenue Magazine. It keeps me up to date on everything in performance marketing.
Yeah, I get all my information online.
I don't see a computer next to your boogie board there.
Well, I've got a regular magazine here.
Revenue Magazine is the only hard copy magazine that covers affiliate marketing techniques, search technologies, online fraud prevention, and interactive advertising, branding, and marketing.
My magazine's got pictures.
Revenue Magazine has everything for online marketers, affiliates, merchants, agencies, and networks. And you can read previous issues, blogs, and more at RevenueToday.com.
Mine's got a centerfold.
Revenue Magazine, the performance marketing standard. For more information, go to RevenueToday.com.
Welcome to Life Tips, the show that offers expert tips and savvy advice to make life easier and more fun on the web and around the world. Life Tips President Byron White talks to the latest trendsetters about strategies to grow your business. Now, please welcome this week's Life Tips host, Byron White.
Super Crunchers, a hot new book that's changing the way that many of us are doing business, Ian Ayres. So, Ian, predicting the future, using numbers to do it, an ambitious task for a professor of law at Yale University to take on. What was the inspiration for this book and your interest in this area?
Well, I'm an economist as well as a lawyer, and I have become obsessed with crunching numbers, initially having to do with legal issues, and it's grown, and I started to notice that this trend toward crunching huge data sets is starting to impact real-world decisions, not just in business, but in medicine, in education, in field after field. Traditional experts who base their predictions on experience and intuition are losing out to a new breed of super cruncher.
For those that are not familiar, if you will, with multivariate testing and A-B testing and the tools that the web marketers are using, maybe you could tap the audience into the fundamentals of regression analysis and how that's being used to predict the future.
Sure. Well, there are two big tools that you can think about. There's the mining of historical data sets with regressions and other statistical algorithms. And then on the other side, there is the creation of your own data with randomized assignment. And both are remaking the way that decisions are made. With regressions, you take historical data and you simultaneously test for multiple possible influences. You troll through and you try to find the independent impact of 5 or 20 or 40 underlying influencers, things that might impact sales or a heart attack. And these are things that people might not have known that they have an influence or certainly couldn't have come up with a very good idea of how big the influence was relative to other causal factors.
Now, how do you find influencers, to use your own language?
Yeah, well, this is one of the things that humans are still centrally important in. There are an infinity of potential causes out there, and it's humans that have to come up with the hypotheses for what is important. But here's something that I think people don't quite understand, is when there are are, let's say, more than 5 or 10 underlying causes. Humans often can pick out, we have agreement, of course, these five are going to be have a causal influence. But we don't have a very good job of figuring out how big a causal influence. And we tend to fall in love with certain hypotheses, and we put too much weight on that. For example, there was a great study that was done on trying to predict Supreme Court votes, how the 9 justices would vote on every case the Supreme Court heard back in the 2002 term. And in one corner, they pitted 83 legal experts, and in the other corner, they pitted an extremely crude statistical prediction algorithm. This statistical algorithm, it didn't even pay attention to the specific issue that the court was hearing, but it did pay attention to something that all humans know, and that is what the Supreme Court dislikes California. It dislikes the Ninth Circuit. And you don't have to be an Einstein to know that if you're in law. But it's hard for humans to figure out how much they dislike the Ninth Circuit. And it turns out just by paying attention and putting the appropriate weights on these 6 crude factors, the statistical algorithm did a better job of predicting the votes than the legal experts.
Tell us a little bit about your famous story of predicting the quality of wine.
Sure. Well, Orly Rauschenfelter, who is one of the great statistical economists in the world, he's a former editor of the American Economics Review, but he has a passion for wine, and he went out and did a regression that predicted, using historical information, predicted wine quality for Bordeaux's based really on just 3 variables having to do with the growing temperature at early in the season and at the time of harvest, as well as the amount of rainfall. And this very simple regression made better predictions than eminent wine tasters, the people that swish and spit, such as Robert Parker. Again and again, we tend to think that the more subtle the prediction, the more you have to rely on experts with years of intuition, gray hairs. But there now have been literally hundreds of tests that suggest that the statistical prediction does a better job.
Hmm. Now, tell us where algorithm prediction can go wrong.
Yeah, well, it certainly can go wrong, and when it goes wrong, people can die, and in finance, when it goes wrong, people can lose their shirts. So it can go wrong, particularly when the analysis is not contestable. We should really be worried when we just trust a single study by a single statistician, that it's we have more confidence when there are multiple studies done by multiple people bringing multiple assumptions to the table. And this is one of the things I think the business still can do a bit better. There is increasing amount of analytic competition where firms are getting into the number crunching game in a big way, but many of them still are too unitary, and I think it would be good for firms and hedge funds to have super crunching audits where some extra people come in and put their eyes on the numbers and re-crunch it to see if it's robust to alternative assumptions.
Do you ever worry about, I want to come back to this later at least 2 or 3 times because I think it's a tough, fascinating question and I want you to think about it as well. Mm-hmm. Do you ever worry that the test results are going to influence quality design?
Well, tell me a little bit more about that. So I guess I think that it will, but I'm not sure it should worry about it. So the simple place where it definitely does is test results are influencing the design of the quality design of web pages. So you do A-B testing in a randomized or alternating fashion, and you find out that putting a picture of a puppy works better than putting a picture of a kitten on the on your web page, and you get 10% more click-throughs, that to me is impacting the quality of your web design, but it's not worrisome. Or if testing tells you that a certain type of consumer is likely to be more interested in buying guitars than drums, and you send them a guitar promotion instead of a drum promotion, you change the quality. So those things are impacting quality, but it's not concerned. So come back at me. What's the story that you're worried about?
Well, when the web began its journey, we looked at websites like Amazon, for example, that featured tens of thousands of individual products, and there was a grid and template design and a clever way to throw other books that people may be interested in that they're considering buying and purchasing. And Amazon, in many ways, helped create a footprint for design that many companies migrated their e-commerce websites after.
Mm-hmm.
So we had a follow the leader path, right?
Yeah.
So with it would seem to me that with multivariate testing, similar results may end up happening. Once you learn a website is testing for variable conversions with different looks and different feels and different designs and ends up landing on a final solution that is the maximized conversion, are we worried that that's going to be a stripped-down version of an Amazon-looking site? So we take a brand like Nike and we tell their ad agency, no more flash, we just want to sell sneakers. And the best way to sell sneakers is this cookie-cutter solution that maximizes the conversion where the images are the following size and the description is short and brief. And, you know, are we going to destroy design? That's my question.
Yeah, so excellent. So I think that we're definitely going to see a shift of power and from traditional graphic designers to non-designers, to A/B testers, and but I actually see that really as a shift in power from the people in the room that have the coolest glasses, the graphic designers, to the consumers. The power, it's the consumers ultimately get to decide what they like. And if they prefer a stripped-down page with not a lot of gewgaws on it, then that's what they should get. And I am agnostic whether it's going to lead toward uniformity of web pages or not. It might, but one thing about this randomized testing is it's not a one-time issue. It was established that as of today, the new pink is purple, but tastes change, and you're going to want to continually test to see what works. And the fact that it works for Amazon, that purple works for Amazon, it might very well be that you make more sales by distinguishing yourself from Amazon. So in perfumes, some manufacturers make a good money by imitating the popular perfumes, just like Armani and other perfumers make profits by distinguishing themselves. And that's what I'm committed to is I think that here, let me put it provocatively. I want to take away the power from those graphic designers that still have a stranglehold over the web page design of things like the New York Times. And I actually think that they're not smarter than fifth graders in the following sense, that if you gave me a half dozen fifth graders and I let them just come up with 50 crazy design elements, I bet I could beat the status quo. I mean, I only need to have, you know, a couple of the 50 do better, and I get a lift over the status quo. And having more people read your newspaper is not a bad thing.
Well, one of the problems with testing in general is a definition of one design or look or feel beating another. Tell us some of the fundamentals about measuring success.
Excellent. Well, it certainly depends on what you care about. And so in some web contexts, it's going to be sales. In others, it's going to be registrations. And in sometimes, it's just going to be stickiness with regard to things like the New York Times and other media. It's going to be the stickiness of the eyeballs. The more banner ads you get people to look at, the more profitable it's going to be for you. So you do need, in order to have valid testing of either the randomized kind or even of the historic kind, you do need to have some consensus, of measurable success. And so, for example, I think it's harder at Yale Law School for us to do super crunching on who to admit, because it's very hard for me to get consensus with my colleagues down the hall here about what it means to be a successful graduate of Yale Law School. Is it making money? Well, yes, but that's not all of it. Is it, you know, clerking on the Supreme Court or becoming a Supreme Court justice? There are just so many dimensions that it's hard to do. And that can be, the multiple dimensions of success make it harder to figure out, to do number crunching in certain contexts. But this isn't normally nearly as big a problem in a lot of e-commerce settings.
Tell us about your thoughts about eHarmony. I know you've spoken about eHarmony and have some thoughts about their whole matchmaking.
I'm a big fan of the wisdom of the crowds, but to me, eHarmony represents kind of a new wisdom of the crowds. What most people talk about in wisdom of the crowds is soliciting the crowd's own beliefs about something, but eHarmony does something different. It's a very different matching site. Instead of asking you who you want to go out with or asking the crowd who you should go out with, they instead just give you a personality test. They don't really care nearly as much about who you want to go out with. They figure out who you are, and then they look at the hidden wisdom of the crowds. They go out to a historic database of tons of married couples, and they look and see what kinds of personalities match well with each other in the sense of having happy marriages. And so eHarmony will end up using this hidden wisdom of the crowds that's hidden in their actual behavior to possibly match you with people you never would have thought you'd like going out with. And it's a very different business model.
Tell us about some of the guidelines that you think webmasters should use in implementing tests and testing variables and different spots on a page, even if you want to get that granular, that people should consider testing to improve conversions.
That's a really great question. You know, and I was just on the phone earlier today with the Federal Trade Commission. They're going to late in about a month, they're having a town hall on behavioral marketing. And a lot of the discussion there is trying to figure out, you know, what are the appropriate ways that this can be used? Are there any concerns? And one simple guideline is if you're using predictive analysis to try to enhance the quality of what you're providing consumers, that's good, and that you should feel happy about that. If you are instead, though, super crunching to predict the individualized price that you can, the highest price you can pull out of them, that causes greater concerns. And Amazon got in trouble a while back when it was doing some randomized testing on price, because people were worried that it was doing demographically contingent pricing. And so if you start, people start doing behavioral contingent pricing or demographic contingent pricing, they're going to, at a minimum, they should disclose to their consumers that they're playing that kind of a game. And just to raise another issue that webmasters should worry about, this, while you've heard that I'm really kind of obsessed and a fan of randomized testing, there are some very legitimate concerns. If randomized tests tell you that, you know, you, it's more profitable for you to bury your warranty provisions, you know, five levels down, or make it really hard for people to find how to send in a rebate, you know, that's going to raise some real questions of deception, even if the randomized test shows you that it's profitable.
What about, those are excellent, don't do this? Do you have any recommendations for try doing this?
Oh, yeah. So, I mean, I definitely just the do's is if you are not doing randomized tests on the graphic elements of your primary landing pages, you know, you're just crazy nowadays, because it's just routine that you can enhance your click-through rate or your sales. You can get 10% lift on the things that, whatever you care about, if you optimize to the thing you care about, by just as simple as, you know, should it be should I put a picture of a puppy, or should I emphasize that we use VeriSign? If you haven't been optimizing and start, you'll get a 10% lift easy, and often more than that. So you want to, and part of the freedom on the web is that randomized testing is so cheap to do that you don't have to limit yourself to testing just two or three different ideas. As a matter of fact, and this might actually make you feel better about this uniformity point, you want to try some crazy ideas. It's so easy to test them. You get quick results, and you can then turn them off if the crazy thing isn't working. Joanne Fabrics, did something very unusual. That it put up a promotion that if you bought two sewing machines, they would give you 10% off on both sewing machines. And this wasn't one of their top hunches for a promotion that would work. Sewing machines aren't the central product that Joann Fabrics sells, and who needs to buy two sewing machines? But it turned out that a randomized test showed that this had a big impact, a big boost to sales, and after the fact, they now understand that they were turning their consumers into salespeople, that one customer would call up a friend and say, hey, how about both of us buying a sewing machine? So instead of necessarily leading toward uniformity, you should do randomized testing and do it on radically different things. So you just don't want to say, oh, do I have a picture here of a woman in a red shirt or a woman in a blue shirt, but you want to have you want to test whether you should have a picture of a woman or a picture of something very different than a woman. I don't know, a racing car going across the finishing line. And so that's a simple idea of the way to do this. And the second thing beside testing is, again, going back and trying to figure out, use either historical data or randomized testing to find out the qualities that your consumers actually want, so that you can give them, you can suggest to them right up the fact that when they land, they see products that they are more interested in purchasing.
Here's a tough question before we take a break.
Okay.
Intellectual, and you get some water and oxygen and other things that you might need with these tough questions.
Yeah, the other ones have been tough too, right?
Intellectual, thank you for answering these tough questions. Intellectual property of the actual test results. who owns it? So if I work with Optimos or Offermatica, some of the other players out there, does the client own that exclusively? Should we be concerned about this, particularly with regards to competitive nature of businesses?
It all depends on what your contract is with Optimos or Offermatica. And routinely, these contracts give the client the rights to this. And again, if this were, you could imagine a circumstance where the information had to be made public so that competitors could also benefit from it. But this is not the kind of, it's not that expensive to create this information. And as the idea of giving the competitors access so they too could free ride on it, I don't see a reason for that. I actually, however, see some not intellectual property, some circumstances where the consumers should have at least knowledge that testing is going on. But even there, I'm not sure they should know the specifics. They should. There might be one of the things that could at least be discussed is disclosure of whether testing is occurring or that it might occur, or some kind of option for consumers. Well, if they just got that disclosure, consumers could choose not to do business with anybody that treats them like a guinea pig. Now, you know, I'm trying to put that in provocative stance, but, you know, I'm happy to be a guinea pig in a lot of circumstances if it's going to lead toward better quality service for me.
One follow-up to the intellectual property issue. So as you know, Google went out and purchased Urchin recently, and has rolled out Site Optimizer, which is a free multivariate testing platform for anybody that has an AdWords account. You know, should we be worried that the brains behind the Google algorithm are going to start analyzing the Site Optimizer results and analyzing who is conforming to most conversive websites and offer priority for those websites in their natural search results listing? I mean, is there really rich data here that's really kind of scary? I guess that's my question.
Well, yes, it's rich, but I just may be missing it, but I don't see. So one thing, it should. Certainly it should be contractable, and whether Google, as in providing this service, it should be governed by contract whether they can also take advantage of this data that is being created through Google AdWords randomization or not. So, and depending on what, if people feel really strongly about it, they can resist letting Google have access to it or not. I actually don't see the problem with Google adding into its algorithm about how high various ads are placed. They seem to have a similar incentive of trying to, as the consumer, trying to get the ads that are most relevant, most to hook up consumers with the sellers that most want to be hooked up with those consumers. And by the way, I may be biased here because the very title of Supercrunchers was picked in part because of a randomized Google AdWords experiment. I started off loving the title, The End of Intuition, but I created a Google ad campaign for people that searched on terms such as data mining and number crunching, and it turned out that Supercrunchers had a 63% higher click-through rate, and that it influenced me in changing the title. So that's kind of the end of my own intuition.
When we return, we're going to take a look at some fun prediction tools that Aaron has put together on his website. So let's take a break, everyone. We'll be back in just a few minutes.
Life Tips on WebmasterRadio.fm. We'll be back with more cool tips and advice right after these commercial messages.
best of the web, the Internet's oldest directory, EOTW.org, since 1994. Our editors scour the web finding quality sites, providing users with spam-free resources, relevant information from valuable sites. Submit your site now for a guaranteed review in 3 days or less. For webmasters needing additional exposure, check out our 60-day free trial on category sponsorships. 60 days free advertising. No kidding. And don't forget the Best of the Web's reseller program with the industry's highest commissions. 25% recurring commission on all products and services. Bloggers, make sure to check out the BOTW blog directory and the recently launched volunteer editor program to help build the best blog resource on the web.
Guys, are you suffering from ED? Email delivery problems? Is your email list underperforming? Then let JPG Mail enhance your results. We've got the best in email enhancement products on the web. Our email delivery service will enlarge and maximize the monetization of your data. JPG Mail will fulfill your needs from data acquisition, management, mailing to reporting, and give you the confidence to pick up visitors, enter a URL easily, and download suppression lists to enjoy that feeling of total satisfaction. We'll give you guys the ultimate tools, and we'll show you how to use them. Email enhancement, where you need it the most. JPGmail.com.
Now back to Life Tips, the show that offers expert tips and savvy advice to make life easier and more fun. Only on WebmasterRadio.fm. Now, here's your host.
Welcome back, everyone. We're here with Aaron In Ayers, the author of Super Crunchers, a must-read book for anybody in the internet-related world or anybody, frankly, interested in predicting the future. Ian, welcome back.
Thank you.
So, prediction tools, interesting concept here. Could you tell everybody where they could find some of your prediction tools if they're listening in on the web as we speak right now? And we'll dive in and ask you some questions about the challenge you've taken on yourself here.
Sure. If you go to www.supercrunchers.com, you'll see a link for prediction tools where I have created and gathered more than 30 prediction tools on all kinds of things so that anybody can plug in some numbers related to themselves or their family, and they can take advantage of super crunching results themselves. So if you surf on over there and you're pregnant, you can put in a few variables, and it'll come up with your due date, or if you want to figure out how tall your kid will be as an adult, you can click on a link and add in, and I guess I'm doing this right now, type in your kid's gender, when the child was born, what date it is now, and some information about the parent's height, and it will make a prediction about how tall the child will be. And that's just that's such a simple thing to do, but there are tons of other things there that go from predicting the outcome of sporting events to predicting the presidential election to and even some very useful ones, such as I'm a great fan of faircast.com, that will make a prediction about whether the fare of an airline ticket will go up and or down between now and when your flight takes off. So if they predict it's going to go up soon, you should go out and buy the ticket now. If they predict it's going to go down, wait and hold off on buying the ticket. And indeed, this Faircast is a great example of a place where the wisdom of the crowds wouldn't work. You know, you could set up a prediction market about whether the airfare between Boston and Chicago is going to go up or down in the next 2 weeks before the flight takes off. But that's, you know, why do you think that the crowd would have good information about that relative to Faircast, which has several terabytes of historic pricing information that they can crunch to find out what the general tendency is.
Now, let's hit the pause button on Sharecast, and this sort of prediction widget might be a good way to summarize this in two words or less. I kind of like that, prediction widget.
Exactly.
It obviously is completely dependent on past information, correct?
Yes.
And so unforeseen economic conditions cannot have any influence. Would you agree with that? Or is there a master switch that would monitor the economic conditions of that you could build into a model like this to predict the future?
Well, there have to be unforeseen variables that if they come down, they could draw these predictions to go badly. You're right. So,
for example, could you build in fuel price, average fuel price or history on fuel price?
Actually, Faircast has done that. That is one of the variables that they have put into their prediction. They take into account, things. So it's not just the historical pricing stuff, but they take into account fuel price, even things like whether there's the team is qualified for the World Series. They go down to, I think, over 100 variables go into their predictions, and they re-predict every morning based on that day's available information. So once they make their prediction that day at 7 a.m., if something unforeseen happens or something that's not on their list of 115 variables impacts it, their prediction can go wrong. But let me tell you, they do take into account fuel price.
What are sources for data that are public sources for the type of information to build a prediction widget?
There are lots of, government is one of the great first sources that they're starting to put up all kinds of property tax information is available, and hence that's one of the ways that Zillow can make predictions about how much your house is worth by looking at the publicly available sales information on other houses. There's increasing availability through setting up data scraping programs that you control the internet and legitimately scrape information that people have left out there for you to use. And so the census leaves all kinds of information out on the internet that data accumulators have started to make available to people in all kinds of circumstances. We tend to think of data scraping as being pernicious because a lot of people have sent out bots to scrape email so that they can spam us, but it's completely legitimate to go to an SEC site and to scrape off from quarterly reports information about firms so that you can build a database about their finances. And this is a world where it is easier and easier to capture digital information, to conglomerate it, to mash it together, and it's gotten way cheaper, of course, to store it. And so part of the lesson that I'm trying to bring, not to the webmasters, but to regular folks out there, is they got to start thinking in terms of terabytes instead of megabytes and gigabytes. You can buy, Dell will happily sell you a desktop with a terabyte of a hard drive space. So this is a new world where there's tons of data available to crunch.
What are some of your other favorite prediction tools that you have listed here? And what was your association with these? Are these just sort of bookmarks for prediction tools?
Yeah, I've created some of them up at the top, but the majority are ones that I've been collecting, and actually people have been sending to me. So if there are any listeners out there that have a favorite prediction widget or applet that they like of the same kind, please please send it on. One of my favorite ones that you can see down here is the Lulu title score. Again, it's this is a different one, and if you're it's kind of addictive. You can plug in different titles of books, and it will come back with a bestseller probability. And of course, this is a probability of a bestseller if you actually are a good author. But it still shows you that people do judge books by their cover a bit, and you can plug in titles that you already know. The Da Vinci Code, by the way, doesn't do a very good job on a bestseller that gets a low ranking, but generally it does a very good job, surprisingly good job, at picking out bestsellers from non-bestsellers, and then you can throw in your favorite, you know, if you have that novel that you were thinking about writing, put in your tentative title and see how it cashes out.
Tell me a little bit about what sort of creative process you would go through in creating a prediction widget.
Sure. Well, mostly what I would do is I look for regression outputs. I look for my favorite studies that that have been able to find underlying causes. And as a matter of fact, just about an hour ago, I was flipping through a wonderful book by Ray Fair called Predicting Presidential Elections and Other Things. And he has some interesting titles, chapters, where he goes through the same process of how you do predictions on specific data sets. And so one thing that I'm going to create a widget on is it turns out that both Psychology Today and the Red Book collected information on marital affairs and what are the factors that influence whether you'll have a marital affair. And these things turn on your age and your number of years of marriage and your subjective marital happiness and your religiosity. And that if you plug in these pieces of information for yourself or maybe for your partner, it will generate a prediction of the likelihood of a marital affair in the next 5 years. And so that's and one of the coolest things about these regression techniques that I really should emphasize is the very same output that gives rise to these predictions, it simultaneously tells you how precise that prediction is. Sometimes a regression will come back and say, well, here's the prediction, but there wasn't very good data, and so it's not a very precise prediction. It could be much higher or lower than this. And other times, the regression will come back and say, yeah, we had a lot of data on this kind of a question, and we can make a pretty precise prediction. You can see this, by the way, on the Faircast website. They'll not only give you a prediction of whether the price of the airline fare is going up or down, but if you look at the site, they'll then say, by the way, for this kind of prediction, we're right 80% of the time, or we're right 65% of the time, depending on the quality of the data they have.
Do you worry that exposing the audience to the results, to the prediction itself, might influence behavior?
Now that is a very good question, and related a bit to the something called the Hawthorne effect. And so yes, now and maybe I haven't put up this this marital affair widget yet. Maybe I should have a care before I do that. A lot of these things, it depends on the thing. I don't think that the predicting your child's height is going to have much of an impact whether the child knows that she'll grow tall or not. because that's not very volitional. But on some of these other tools, it's possible that that there will be this feedback effect that could either increase the chance that it's going to come true, or decrease it, or can cause some other kind of damage. But let me say the purpose of the site is more frivolous. It's in some sense a provocation. A lot of people want to say, well, how can super crunching impact me? And this is just to give you a taste. Actually, with I've had a lot of there's kind of an iron law that people have the hardest idea seeing how super crunching could help them do what they do. We all tend to think that what we do is too special. And lots of interviewers have been making that claim to me. And just as another provocation, my son and I went out and we coded a bunch of Stephen Colbert interviews. And it turns out that Colbert asked different kinds of questions to different kinds of guests, and that this comes out pretty clearly if you just crunch some numbers on this. And so even interviewers or even interviewees might be aided by a little bit of number crunching.
At the same time of their of the crowd being exposed to influencing their behavior in a negative way, or one a way that would be inverse, don't you think the opposite is true, that you know people could be alerted to a caution flag?
For example, Colbert asked different questions to men than he asked to women. Right? And so he might, if he learned about that, he might say, "Oh, he could either embrace that, or it says it works for him, or he might reflectively say, no, I didn't mean to do that." It's one thing. We find that he asks different questions to people that have a visible political affiliation from those that don't. He tends to treat so-called experts that different than non-experts. My son is 12. People that my 12-year-old deems to be famous, he asks different questions to them than to people that are non-famous by his light. There could be feedback mechanisms, and whether some of them might be positive. I mean, indeed, that's one of the great values of doing this, is that you might learn something that causes you to change your behavior. Because that's why you do the test in the first place. And to give another example that I actually worked on in the earlier this year, the New York Times published an article about a statistical study done by Justin Wolfers, providing pretty strong and worrisome results that NBA refs tended to call fewer fouls against players of their same race. And so black refs had fewer fouls against black players, white refs had fewer fouls against white players, and that it's not a huge effect, but enough that a all-white crew versus an all-black crew might impact, cause there to be about a 3% change in the likelihood of winning a game. And so I don't want to say it's dramatic, but this is consequential, and the NBA should want to know about that and see if there's anything it can do to get rid of this small effect. So sometimes feedback effects we should hope for.
If you were to detect a web page on an e-commerce site, what areas of the page or what elements on the page would be the most likely to positively improve conversions?
Yeah, so here you, I should say, I know a lot about this, but you should go to the pros at places like Offermatic, who have a lot more knowledge. But just to start, you're going to want to know how much how many links, how much busyness you give people. So you want to test whether giving them fewer links to click through, whether you drive them to register, for example, whether that's a more successful strategy than giving them tastes of other content is one thing. And that's, you just have to, there's a trade-off. People need to have some information, and they won't register unless they get enough information, but too much will just, they'll be satisfied with all the free information and they won't register. So that's one thing you're going to want to test on how much you emphasize the price, how big it is, or emphasize the possibility of promotions or discounts. You'll want to play with the graphic elements. But in some ways, these elements are, there's so many dimensions of them that I think the big lesson is that you shouldn't really pay particular attention to me. You should dream big yourself and try some crazy stuff. Now, when I say really, there's going to be limits. The idea, you don't want to go out and, if you're a weight loss site, you don't want to say, try the all-fat diet. But as far as the graphic elements, what aspects to run, try a bunch of different things. And indeed, one of the lessons, here's a great story from eHarmony. eHarmony wanted to find out whether forcing people to register before they got any, before they could click through, whether that was more successful than giving them maybe three links for that they could go check out free information before they registered. And it turned out they did a randomized test on this, and in the United States, forcing people to register before they got information did better, but in Canada, forcing people to register before they got information did a lot worse. And eHarmony doesn't run commercials in Canada, and so people don't know as much about the product. And so part of what randomization will tell you is actually how is possibly the different segments of your base should be treated differently.
Do you have a thought on what size test is adequate to draw conclusions?
There is a fancy technical answer to power equations that you can run, and most of the optimization sites will happily give you some specifications on this. But if you for most large effects, if you start getting 10,000 page views comparing two different elements, that's going to be so 5,000 on one versus 5,000 on another, that's going to be enough where you can very quickly start seeing that one is winning the horse race.
And you know, first of all, I want to thank you today for joining the show. We've got a few minutes left to ask you a couple more questions. But do you have a feel in your yet for the number of people actually out there using multivariate testing on their websites? Do you have any data on that that you've heard through the grapevine with your conversations with Offermatic or Optimus or some of the other companies that have asked you to come and talk with their clients about this fascinating area? Do you have a feel for that?
Well, I only have a vague feel, I was talking to a reporter from Ad Age who said, "Oh, isn't everybody doing this?" Everybody from a I have a sense that the majority of large websites have started into the game. And that's, even there, notice I have shied away from telling you whether it's, where it is between 51% and 99%. But I have a sense that wherever that is, that the penetration of this declines as the size of the website goes down. In some ways, that's reasonable. You know, if you really are a ma and pa website with very few hits, then there's not a lot of value for doing this, or there's going to be a limitation to how many different tests you can run. If you're only, or if it's a blog, you know, that only three people come to a year, including your mom and dad, you know, you're not going to get much of a value out of doing randomized testing. But on a volume basis, I think that it is, I think that more and more firms are doing this, and what you're seeing from Google and others is we're also starting to see a democratization of this, that we're going to see it push down to lower and lower levels, and that you're going to, we're going to start seeing software that allows people to do it themselves. Google already allows people to set up these randomized campaigns on Google Ads, but we're going to be able to, we're going to see it wrapped into other software so it can be, you can edit it right into your HTML code.
The testing and the regression analysis, the algorithms, you know, the crunching of data, it seems like it covers a lot of areas. For the webmasters, you know, an opportunity to improve conversions. For the human element, and perhaps an understanding to better ourselves, for other people a chance to feel good and confirm that they're on the right track in life. What do you think that in the end of the day, number crunching can really do to help make life better? And is it just gonna, are we just gonna fall more in love with crunching numbers, or do you think there's a danger zone in there somewhere too?
Yeah. So generally, it's making more accurate predictions is going to. It already has improved our quality of life. It's already started to lead toward better choices in medicine. It's starting to have an impact in improving our educational system. Now that we're going to more data-driven educational decisions, but there are some downsides. Before we mentioned it's when it's bad, inaccurate predictions, people can be hurt. But even accurate predictions from the can be used for inappropriate purposes. And I do worry that that there are some contexts where hidden data mining can lead toward pricing or warranty decisions that negatively impact consumers. And in some way, there are firms that are going out and predicting consumers' happiness and then trying to make sure that nobody walks away too happy. If you're super crunching, so here's a concern that it's kind of the corporate Zoloft that it evens out the highs and lows of consumer happiness. If they predict that you're really unhappy and about to switch suppliers, they'll come in and start throwing bennies at you to keep you happy. But if you're too happy, they say, well, look, we can raise the price or reduce the quality of our service, and he's still going to stay with us. So that's the kind of concern. And the second thing that I think we should keep in mind, this is a world where super crunching tends to lead to decreased discretion by frontline employees, that once you have figured out that a particular algorithm or a script or a routine does a better job, then you're not going to want to give discretion to the loan officers that we used to give to the school teachers. We make movies about innovative, inspiring school teachers, but you know, I tend to believe that half of school teachers are below average, and that you know, to build a educational system around the possibility of a few exceptional teachers is, I think, has now been demonstrated to not work as well as more routinized systems, and this does raise a very separate concern. This may not be the best world for human flourishing if you're a line item employee. You're like, even physicians are starting to lose discretion. Patients aren't treating them like the oracles of all wisdom. They instead are showing them as a substitute for a web portal because they say, I found this on WebMD. Why should I believe what you said? You know, or show me the study. They're reaching through the physician to get to the underlying information.
One final question for you, and I'm certain it's impossible to answer, sir. But if you were to predict the future, about predicting the future, what do you see? How much influence do you think algorithmic prediction of the future is going to come into play with business decisions, financial decisions, life-making decisions? I mean, how connected are we going to become in 20 to 50 years from now with detailed analysis?
Well, so one thing I predict is that we're going to see a radical increase in our statistical knowledge, that high school courses in statistics will increasingly replace calculus. They're much, much more valuable than calculus. So, about 2% of college graduates ever use their calculus. 100% of high school graduates can use statistics, at least as being informed consumers. So we're going to, that's coming increasingly. We're going to see more people are going to have to get into the game. And we're going to see, secondly, an evolution instead of a fight between intuition and numbers. We're going to see people, the best decision makers, are going to be able to toggle back and forth between their intuitions and statistics. That this super crunching, it doesn't mean the end of intuition, but it increasingly means that you're going to have to be willing to put your intuition to the test.
Well, on that note, Ian, thank you very much for joining our show today.
A pleasure. You're a tough questioner.
And tune in, everyone, next week. Thanks to all of our friends over at Webmaster World, Eddie and the gang, putting the show together. Until next week, everyone, we'll hope your life gets better, smarter, faster, and wiser with now numbers added to your list of things to focus on. See you next week.
Choose the right affiliate program to partner with? Hey, all we're trying to do is make the most money in the least amount of time. The answer is simple. JoeBucks.com, the world's leading herbal affiliate program. JoeBucks.com is the direct manufacturer, so there's no middleman. This will allow you to make up to 50% the highest payouts on the net and also get paid twice a month. Sign up today and watch your income grow. JoeBucks.com.
All right, you freeloaders, that's enough. If you want to hear more of this WebmasterRadio.fm program, then subscribe right now to our VIP membership for less than 99 cents a day. Log on now to WebmasterRadio.fm and subscribe today.